Hello and welcome to the programme. You can visit our website anytime you like, rte.ie/Mooney. Today, the mellifluous sound of the blackbird. Or is it? We find out all about the Irish State Forestry Body's newest project, Caoilte Nature.
When Caoilte was formed in 1989, ideas of climate change and biodiversity loss were really not in wide circulation. But times have moved on, so we're looking at major conservation projects, nature restoration projects, and we hope later this year to get involved in native woodland afforestation projects again.
And we discuss the latest findings from research carried out by Oregon State University, which suggests counting fish using their DNA is a lot safer and more accurate than the gold standard method of electrofishing.
eDNA is an approach that allows us to take a water sample so we don't have to actually harm or handle the fish. So it's a non-invasive sampling approach. I think there are some fish species that are sensitive enough that when you touch them, you can tell that it's very uncomfortable for them. I would say any fish tries to get out of your hand. It doesn't want to be held or captured by you. So as a scientist, you try to minimize the amount of handling time that you have with a fish, and you get it down to where you're only holding them for a few seconds before you're returning them to a bucket or to the stream side, to the stream where they originated, because they don't like to be handled.
Yeah, we've got a very packed program ahead of us today, filled with stories from the natural world. So let's begin by meeting our panel. We head first to Greystones in County Wicklow, and we say hello to Niall Hatch.
Hi, Derek. How are you?
All good. Thank you very much indeed. Anything happening in your neck of the woods?
Well, you were telling me just the other day that you were trying to film a wagtail with your phone, and it was proving very difficult because the bird kept disappearing on you. I've been noticing a lot of wagtail activity around my area just the last few days. And what I'm noticing is that the wagtails are starting to scrap with each other. They're getting, you know, a little bit pugnacious. I think that it might be the longer days now gradually happening. It's triggering these breeding hormones. And although they aren't ready to nest yet and they're not keeping territory, they are starting to see off their rivals and start to get a little bit, you know, posturing and you know, trying to jockey for position. And so that's been interesting.
Why is a pied wagtail called a willy wagtail, and why does it wag its tail?
So willy wagtail, I suppose it's just it's one of those nice little folk names. There's another bird completely unrelated in Australia also called the willy wagtail. It's a species of fantail, another group of birds entirely. I think it flows off the tongue very nicely, doesn't it? It's nice and familiar. And of course, the pied wagtail is a species that we associate with human habitation. They seem to love tarmac and concrete. I always associate them with car parks and train station platforms. That seems to be what they like. So I think in this case, it's familiarity. We sort of conferring this moniker on them that shows that, you know, this bird has a special place in our hearts. As for why they wag their tails all the time, nobody is completely sure about this. It must serve some purpose because it would be a waste of energy because they constantly do it. The pied wagtail, that, you know, the black and white fellow, the willy wagtail, as we said, many people know it, they tend to be found away from water. But many other wagtail species related to it are found close to water, such as the grey wagtail, which I always think is one of the most inappropriately named birds in Ireland because they're actually bright yellow below. So when you see it, you think yellow is the first colour that hits the eye. They're usually by fast-flowing streams. And one of the theories with them is that they bob their tails so that it mimics the action of the moving water, and their white outer tail feather sort of hides them against the foam on top of the water. Maybe that's the case. I don't know. It could be, and therefore an evolutionary hangover that also the pied wagtails have inherited. And because it's no big disadvantage, they haven't evolved away from doing it. But that's just a theory.
Richard Collins is in Malahide. Richard, could you proffer a theory also?
Well, Derek and Niall, I think it has to do with manoeuvrability. If you look at the animals that have special tails, monkeys, squirrels and things, the animals whose tails wag them, they're all climbers and they're able to go up vertical faces and go into places nobody else could. Now, if you look at the little wagtail, the willy wagtail, his great haunt, roosting haunt, used to be O'Connell Street. And from the willy wagtail's point of view, our cities are cliffs, collections of cliffs, vertical cliffs. Now, if you want to exploit the little creepy crawlies that come out in places like O'Connell Street, there's lots of people having takeaways and discarding offal and the occasional throw up dare I say it, is lots of creepy crawlies come out to feed on the detritus that we produce, and the wagtail cashes in on that, on the little insects that come to feed on that. So, and wagtail can fly into O'Connell Street, can maneuver up and down those vertical cliffs effortlessly, doesn't have to worry. Hawks have long tails for that, and falcons have long tails for much the same reason. Tails are about aerodynamics, and I think that's probably the factor. I have a theory that wagtails are much better at avoiding collisions, being run over by traffic, than other birds, because they have the tail to get them out of danger quickly. The tail gives them the opportunity to jump out of the way and avoid things, you see. But to prove this, you would have to have stretches of road, document all the species killed, relate that to the abundance of the species, but I think I seldom see dead wagtails on the road, and I see lots of the other things dead. It's just a theory. It's probably cockeyed, but I think it has to do with the manoeuvrability of the tail.
But that doesn't explain why it's wagging the tail up and down, Richard, and that's my question.
Wagging the tail up and down. Well, now that is interesting. It does wag the tail up and down. I don't know. If you were balancing, you wouldn't keep your tail steady all the time. You're using the movement of the tail as a kind of reference, do you see? You know what you can do. You feel the power of your manoeuvrability in your tail. You know, you don't leave it statically there and activate it suddenly when the car is coming. It's part of what the wagtail is, its tail.
You might be onto something there, Richard. I mean, I'm wondering if partially it's keeping those muscles active and exercised so that they can take flight at a moment's notice. Because you know, you do see wagtails walking around on roads more than you do other species. They spend more time on roads, and yet you tend to see fewer of them killed on the roads, so they would seem to be more adept at avoiding traffic, certainly. What I think is very interesting about them too is, unlike most small songbirds which hop along on the ground, wagtails do walk and run with one foot in front of the other, kind of like the way that we humans do, of course, and the way that crows do. So maybe there's something in that too. They spend a lot of time on the ground. They're very highly adapted for that terrestrial existence. So maybe the bobbing of the tail has something about, being able to help them to balance and help them to get ready to fly away if danger approaches.
Walking is a much more sophisticated activity than hopping, I believe. That's the adaptations you need to put left, right and control things are much more advanced on those of just hopping from branch to branch, you know. So the wagtail is a bird that is very impressive in all kinds of ways, and he's a bird that has thrived on our civilization.
Absolutely. And a gorgeous bird to look at. And I can never resist an opportunity to stare when I see one. And I follow them. I mean, they walk along until you get so close and then they're gone. Anyway, I want to talk to you about an email we received into the programme. This is something we've featured on Mooney Goes Wild many times over the past 25 years. But it's always of interest to our listeners. It's an email and it comes from Patrick Clark, who lives in Knockline in Dublin, and he says, "Hi Derek and team, I think we have a partial albino blackbird visiting our garden, and I was wondering if you could confirm from the attached pics. I've never seen one before this year. How rare are they?" And indeed, Patrick has sent us some photographs, and we've put them on the website, rte.ie/Mooney. I think the first time we looked at an albino bird, Richard, has got to have been over 20 years ago.
Indeed, yes, I remember. I have a long association with albino birds because I got an albino rook many years ago, which I put in Dublin Zoo because it was obstinate and rejected by the other rooks. And it lived for many years in the big aviary in Dublin Zoo. So that's pure albino now. A pure albino is a situation where genetically you do not produce colour at all for your plumage. Your natural colour everywhere. This bird, however, is not like that. It is only white on the head. Now, there is a condition called leucism, which means a general depletion of colours. The colours are not so strong, but I don't think it's quite leucistic either. What do you think, Niall?
Certain types of colour are produced in different ways, and the black in a blackbird, it's produced by pigments called melanins, and the birds intrinsically make these in their own bodies. When you look at a bird that has black or it has brown or it has grey in it, and certain even deep russet tones, they're produced by the bird intrinsically. So very often there's a genetic basis to the lack of those pigments in that bird, and that can be inherited by the offspring of these birds, or sometimes by their grandchildren, because it might skip a generation because it's a recessive gene. That that may be the case here, but you know, if you see white blackbirds or white-headed blackbirds cropping up in the population down the line, then it probably has a genetic component. Certainly, when it comes to the reds and yellows in birds' plumage, they come from the diet, and birds aren't capable of making those. So a perfect example would be the yellow on the chest of a blue tit. They can only get that from the food that they eat, and they have to have the right kind of nutrition when the feathers are growing. And one source of that is actually in the vegetable material that's inside the stomachs of the caterpillars that they eat, because plants can produce that pigment, these different chemicals that are in them there, that the caterpillars get them in their stomachs, and then the birds get them from there. So if they're not eating the right kind of caterpillars, the right kind of food at the right time of year, that yellow will disappear. Red is produced in a similar way. Blue in a bird is produced entirely by microstructures in the surface of a feather that are reflecting a wavelength of light within a certain wavelength. So that's, we see that as blue. So that's not pigment at all. And then green is even trickier. Green is produced by a combination of that reflecting blue light with the underlying yellow pigmentation that comes from a bird's diet. So it's very, very complex. I think that why we see blackbirds with random white patches, and also this happens to members of the crow family, particularly jackdaws. I often, when I go to Dublin Zoo, or when I was able to go there before COVID, there's a lot of the jackdaws that are flying wild around Dublin Zoo have random white patches on them. This seems to be sort of a genetic little, you know, maybe an inbred population within the zoo, but it certainly occurs there more frequently. And I think because the pigmentation, the colour pigmentation in those birds is so simple, it's just pure black, that a simple switching on or off of a gene or a little mutation could mean that the pigments couldn't appear in the feather. So that's why they're white. Now, it's interesting that the correspondent there mentioned that the bird looked like a partial albino, but that's actually an oxymoron. Something can't be a partial albino. Albinism, as Richard correctly said, it's defined as the complete absence of all pigmentation. So if there's some pigmentation there, then the bird can't be albino. It's like a person can't be a little bit pregnant. You either are or you aren't. It's the same with being an albino. No, Derek, you either are or you aren't.
Anyway, I came across something very interesting for you both to listen to, and indeed our listeners to listen to at home. I'm going to play you the sound of a bird singing, and I want you to tell me which bird this is.
Yes, that's the blackbird. Beautiful sound, low pitched, and there's a paper published recently which said that birds which sing try to be as big as possible. The bigger the body, the lower pitched the sound, and the better a sound travels, the lower pitched it is. So it's a very interesting one.
Now I want you to have a listen to this bird. Can you tell me what it is, please, Niall? Any ideas? Have a listen.
Well, Derek, that sounds very unusual. That song sounds a bit wonky to me. It's not the song that you would certainly hear in the wild within Ireland, within nature. It sounds to me almost like a bird that has learned the wrong song. The elements of a robin in there is kind of fast and a bit jaunty, a bit squeaky. So quite different to the fluty, mellow, slower song of the blackbird we heard earlier.
Well, I can tell you both that it's actually a pure albino blackbird, which I managed to find on the internet, and it's in a cage, which may indeed have affected its song, because it could be learning songs from other birds around it in other cages, but it is a pure albino blackbird. So is it possible that this albino bird has a different song, and that all albino birds have a different song to their brothers and sisters, let's say?
Well, a bird shouldn't have a different song to its brothers and sisters, or its immediate siblings, because songbirds, like blackbirds, they learn their song from their father, because with this species, it's just the male that sings. So there's obviously, you know, a certain template there within their bodies. Their vocal apparatus is arranged in a certain way so that the pitch is usually around the same. But if they don't hear their father singing at the crucial stage of development when they're still in the nest, they'll sing the wrong song and they'll be influenced by other birds. So I don't think that the fact that the bird is an albino in this case has anything to do with it. An albino should sing a perfectly normal song, because the genes that control its colour have nothing to do with its voice. I think that the key here is that bird was probably bred in captivity. It wasn't exposed to blackbirds when it was growing at that formative stage when it's still a nestling, and it may indeed have learned the song, or tried to imitate the song, of another captive bird of some species. You know, in cage birds it could be anything from all over the world. It could be an exotic species. It's certainly not one that I recognise. So I think that's what's going on here. So I don't think it's actually the white plumage. I think it's more to do with the development of the bird itself when it was listening for the songs.
probably a bird bred for its white plumage, you know, the way poulterers breed white birds rather than the normal brown and dark grey ones, geese and ducks and things like that. And of course, the reason is that they save money by doing so, because little chicks growing up don't have to make pigment, so they don't need as much food and they grow up more quickly. So you can sell them off for the table sooner if they are white than if they were brown. And in fact, there is a theory. Mrs. Beaton, the famous, you were a great cook, Derek. Well, now Mrs. Beaton said that white fowl were tenderer than normal brown fowl, for instance. And the Romans, for instance, used to prefer a liver of white geese to that of normal grey geese. So this has to do with the lack of melanin in the fibre, which meant that things were less strong, they were delicate, less forceful. But so the poulterers went for that. And if you wanted to breed a white blackbird, you could do so if you had an aviary and you keep on breeding out the strains until you got a white one, and then you might get away with that.
Was Mrs. Beaton not the goddess of domestic science or something like that, Richard, back in the 1800s?
Yeah, she wrote a famous book about household management. Yeah. And I cook, but my cook is of the most humble kind, you know. The interesting one, I think, is the snow goose. The snow goose has two phases, a coloured phase known as a blue phase, mm-hmm. and a white phase. So you have these two contending versions of the snow goose. They're all snow geese and they can interbreed, although they generally like their own colour, or lack of it, as the case may be. Well, now the interesting thing about that is that the white birds hatch earlier than the coloured ones, and the chicks grow up earlier than the coloured ones. So they have an advantage in that regard. They get through quickly, through where the Arctic foxes and things could come and attack them. They get the chicks off and away while the danger lasts. Whereas the blue-faced fellow has bigger touch and lasts longer, but his chicks tend to be stronger. But both of these traits have been retained in the snow goose population, and you still get both of them.
It's interesting when you get bird species like that that have two different colour phases, because it shows us something about their evolutionary history. The theory about how this would have happened with snow geese and with other birds like skuas, for example, certain birds of prey too that show colour phases, is that in some time in the distant past, populations of these must have become separated, perhaps by glaciation or something like that. They evolved independently of each other, but not to the extent that they became separate species. And then what happened was the glaciers retreated, or whatever, the ice age ended. And then the populations came back into contact with each other. And although they were different, they were still able to relatively freely interbreed. So they weren't new species. But these two different colour patterns still remained within the population. And the fact is that there must be an advantage to both types of colour. Otherwise, one of them would most likely have died out due to evolutionary pressure. So they must be both getting some sort of advantage from their different colours. Certainly, when it comes to white birds, as you mentioned, Richard, their feathers tend to be looser and more fragile. That's because the melanin pigments in dark feathers help to protect them and make them strong. So that's why white birds like the white phase snow geese often have black wingtips, because the wingtips, when they're flying, they're subject to the most wear and tear of any feather on the body. So that means that they're more likely to fall apart and fray. So black wingtips means the wingtips will be stronger. That'll carry a long distance migrant like the snow goose over a long, you know, on its migration without any adverse consequences. You sometimes see white birds like little egret, for example. They don't move anywhere near as much during their lives, so they're more sedentary, so they don't need such strong feathers. But it's also one of the reasons why a lot of albino birds tend not to survive very long. So a bird like a blackbird, if it's an albino, well, it's generally hiding in a garden or in a park or in a forest. It's away from predators, so although it's more visible to predators and more likely to be nabbed because its camouflage isn't so good, at least it's feathers aren't subject to the rigors of migration, so they're not subject to that wear and tear. But if you look at a bird like a swallow, for example, because we do get some reports of white swallows each year, and that's always in the summer and in the autumn time, never in the spring, because unfortunately those white swallows, very beautiful birds, but they don't survive the migration to Africa. Their feathers fall apart on the way. There's too much wear and tear. And there's a reason why long distance migrants like swallows have dark wings. And another problem that albinos have is because they lack all pigment, they also lack it in the irises of their eyes, which means that they have no protection from the UV rays of the sun. So unfortunately, they often go blind from the sunlight. And obviously, for a bird like a swallow that's flying in direct sunlight for long distances, it just can't survive that. Whereas a white blackbird, you know, hiding again in the undergrowth, it's not exposed to so much sunlight, so its survival chances are a bit better.
So just to recap for the benefit of the listeners and Patrick, who sent in the email, he does not have a partial albino. That is impossible.
No, because you can't be a partial albino. So it's definitely an aberrant blackbird. As Richard said there, there's some question of whether you could call it leucistic or not. Depends on how that's really defined. Some would say that's the absence of some, but not all pigment. The term partial albino shouldn't be used, but certainly it's an aberrant blackbird or one with aberrant plumage.
Albinism doesn't just occur in birds, Richard.
Not only that, it's in all species. It happens in people. There is about one in something like 10 to 20,000 people is an albino. But it also happens in plants. 1690, the year of the Battle of the Boyne, in Thuringia, Germany, a beech was identified, a copper-coloured beech, a purple beech, as they called it, I believe, then. And 99% of the beeches, the copper beeches all over the world now, are descended from that tree, I believe. There it's the same sort of thing, leucism occurring in a tree.
Does it happen in fish? We're going to find out now. Let's say hello to fishery scientist Ken Whelan. Hello, Ken, who's in Rathgar in Dublin. How are you today, Ken?
I'm grand, Derek. Thank you very much. Well, albinism in fish, we do find it from time to time, but mostly it's actually recorded in aquaria. Certainly it has been recorded in the wild in species like sharks and rays and so on. I think the problem is that if it's in any sort of open water species in an aquatic environment, I'm afraid a fish that is very pale in colour doesn't last very long, either in terms of the predators that might feed on it, or indeed its ability to be able to catch its prey. So it does exist, but it's not that widespread in fish.
Ken, goldfish come in all sorts of colour schemes and sizes and everything else. Presumably this is cashing in on the ability of fish to have unusual colour inheritances.
Yes, it certainly is. And interestingly, goldfish are one of the species where the albinism is recorded on a reasonably regular basis. The reason being, of course, that they're in captivity. But certainly fish are absolute masters in terms of colour, whether it's colour to try and hide or whether it's colour to try and frighten the other fish that may be preying on them. So they have all sorts of different features and the ability to be able to change very quickly in many instances, like some of the flatfish that can blend in completely with a sandy bottom. So colour and melanin and pigmentation are really, really important to fish.
Where does the silver come from? Fish have a curious way of deflecting the light out in only one direction, the silver. You notice with the shoal, when it suddenly turns, there's a flash of light coming from their sides because the sides are turned towards you. Now, that seems to be an extraordinary adaptation. They're invisible most of the time, but if you happen to be in the right place, you can see the light. It's all concentrated in one direction, or is it?
Well, I think, yes, you see them when they flash. And obviously, in the context of migratory species such as salmon, even though they have all the natural colours of a brown trout, really, when they're in fresh water, they put on this silver coat. It's a chemical called guanine that's expressed in the skin of the fish. And they become extremely silvery. And the reason is that when they get into the ocean, if you're a predator underneath and you're looking towards the light, and there's silvery fish above you, it is actually very difficult for the predator to see them. But you're right, they do give their presence away in terms of their propensity to flash from time to time. But I think really, generally, they move very far and very fast. And I think other fish will find them quite difficult to try and prey on.
Does that ability come from the structure of the cells rather than pigment or anything like that? It seems to me that it's a kind of a crystalline thing, or is it?
Yes, it is very, very much a sort of crystalline coating that goes on the fish themselves. And it's tied in as well with the changes in the base of the gills, because the gills obviously have to change to an environment where there's a huge amount of salt. So they actually have to get rid of the salt when they're in salt water. They have to actually try and retain the salt when they're in fresh water. So it's an enormous change to go from fresh to salt. But certainly coloration is really important to them, because when they come back into fresh water, after a few weeks, certainly the adult salmon and indeed the adult sea trout as well, they'll actually take up the original colours that they had in fresh water. So nature has this extremely well designed in terms of being able to switch on and off. And really the albinism then is really to do with this recessive gene, this gene that isn't that frequently expressed. And when it is expressed, it's a very unusual feature and, of course, attracts attention from all of the other fish or all of the other predators around.
Ken, will you explain to our listeners what electrofishing is, please? And I have a reason for asking you.
Oh, electrofishing. OK, well, electrofishing is where we put a current through the water and the fish themselves have a very sensitive lateral line system that indeed has a sort of biological electricity attached to it. And the electrical current they found in the past, it can actually draw fish towards you so that if you're very good at electrofishing, you can actually draw the fish, even though they may not want to swim towards you, you can draw the fish into the electrofishing net and then pop them into a great big tank to check them or maybe just to check on the size or the condition of the fish. They recover quite quickly and then they're released. So it's a fairly standard practice. But it is nowadays, it's quite involved in terms of the licensing that you require and in terms of the cost of actually having the appropriate equipment, the training for the people and trying to travel to the different locations where you need to do the surveys.
Well, counting fish is an essential task in protecting aquatic ecosystems. And scientists all over the world are involved in this process on an ongoing basis. And as you've heard Ken describe there, up to now, the standard method of establishing the presence of fish has been electrofishing. Stretches of rivers are sectioned off and electric probes are placed on the riverbed with a current running between them. This temporarily stuns any fish in the vicinity and enables environmentalists to count and measure them. But now, increasingly, a new method is being employed for counting fish, which uses DNA found in the water to measure numbers, which presumably is a lot more pleasant for the fish. Sampling of eDNA has already been used here in Ireland to detect the presence or absence of the endangered pearl mussel, as well as brown trout and sea lamprey. And it's currently being used to detect salmon. I'm sure Ken will talk about that later. But new research just published by Oregon State University has revealed that using eDNA to count fish can be more accurate than electrofishing without disrupting the fish. The lead author of the report is Brooke Penaluna, a research fish biologist at the Pacific Northwest Research Station, from where she joins us now. Brooke, thank you very much indeed for taking the time to speak with us today. Can you begin by explaining exactly what eDNA is? Because we already know what electrofishing is.
Hi, Derek. eDNA is short for environmental DNA, and it is cells that slough off of plants and animals into the environment, and then scientists can go out and collect the samples of water, in this case, to identify the species that are found in that water using their eDNA.
And how do you go about collecting the eDNA exactly? Can you describe the method, please?
Sure. So we go out to a stream and we take a spot in the middle of the stream where the water's flowing down. We call it the thalweg, the main part of the stream. Oftentimes you can see where the water's flowing more fiercely, and we'll put on a pair of gloves and we face upstream and we'll take a scoop of 1 liter of water with our gloved hands and we'll put the top on it and we put that into our bag. So normally streamside at one site, we'd collect 3 replicate samples and then we take those samples from the stream and we'll process them streamside. So we push that water through a filter and then we take those filters back to the lab and in the lab we extract and run the samples to identify the trout we're looking for from that sample.
So you could be getting all sorts of eDNA in your samples, so you have to eliminate everything and just focus in on one particular species. Is that how you do it?
That's exactly right. In this case, for this work, that's exactly what we did. But there is all that extra information on the filter about the entire stream assemblage in there. So you can get information from the fishes, the amphibians, the macroinvertebrates, the pathogens, and even some of the terrestrial mammals that cross or use that part of the stream. And so you can get information from the stream and riparian area around that sample.
What are the benefits of eDNA over the gold standard of electrofishing, would you say?
eDNA is an approach that allows us to take a water sample so we don't have to actually harm or handle the fish. So it's a non-invasive sampling approach. And it tends to be comparable in cost to electrofishing or slightly less. And it allows us to understand what's there in a more sensitive way. So it's essentially a more sensitive way to sample fishes when they're in low densities.
Would you say it's more accurate?
We did a study here in the Pacific Northwest of the United States in the states of Washington and Oregon. We went out to 60 streams and we had 8 different sites in each stream that were located 50 meters apart. And we wanted to detect whether we detected trout there or not. And we compared our eDNA results to the traditional approach of electrofishing, where you wear a backpack electrofisher on your back and you have an electrode that comes from the water and you slightly stun them, but you visually get to detect the fish in the water. So we wanted to detect this traditional approach of electrofishing to eDNA. And what we found is that in over half of the streams, eDNA detected trout higher in the stream network than did the traditional approach by anywhere from 50 to 250 meters above, thereby extending that upper edge of distribution of trout.
Ken, I know you want to get in on this. Ken Whelan.
Brooke, just to explain to our listeners in terms of the eDNA that you were looking for, how is that released from the fish? What actually gives you the ability to be able to detect it in the water?
eDNA comes from plants or animals, and there's cells that are sloughed off from those animals into water or soil or sediments or air. They're essentially in the environment all around us. And we just scooped up the water, since fish live in the water, we scooped up the environment that they live in, and we tried to detect from that and their sloughed skin cells in the water bottle sample that we collected.
In terms of the fish then, these beautiful cutthroats, which I'm glad to say I actually have caught in the past along the Pacific Northwest, just to explain to our listeners why those cutthroats are so special in terms of their environmental status.
So coastal cutthroat trout are a Pacific trout native to Western North America. And they're found from Alaska all the way through Canada and into Northern California. And so they have a really broad distribution in Western North America, but they also have a broad distribution within our watershed. So they're found out in the ocean and they swim all the way up our streams, and they are the fish that is found the highest up in our stream network. So our other Pacific salmon drop out in the main stem or as you move up into our tributaries, and so do our inland fishes, but the coastal cutthroat trout are found all the way from the river mouths to the highest up in the stream. So you find them way up in our small forested headwater streams.
And I guess when you're working there, when you were working there pre-eDNA, it would have been really expensive to try and fly people into these very remote areas with all of that electrofishing gear.
Yes, generally the way that we'd sample is we would drive to the sites in a vehicle and electrofish. So our crews would be 2 to 4 people doing the sampling in the field to identify fish presence. And a lot of times the reasons why we want to do it is we just want to understand distribution of those fish species in the watersheds, but also because in this part of the world, there's implications within the forestry sector as well, because where fish are found in streams, the forest next to the stream is managed differently. They tend to have wider forest buffer strips than they do above where fish are found.
So in reality, the cutthroat trout is actually acting like a sort of aquatic canary, in that it's actually the indicator species for whether or not the management around those streams is sufficient to hold the stock of fish in place.
Yes, that's right.
Brooke, it strikes me listening to you that electrofishing and eDNA give a different kind of result in a way. The eDNA would seem to me to be good for detecting presence or absence, but the electrofishing would give you a handle on quantities, how many of the various fish are around, and presumably the electro approach yields information about other species that may be relevant or species that you didn't think were there. So it seems to me that these two should be rather complementary methods.
That's exactly right. And that's what we concluded, is that it depends on what it is, what your objectives are, and what it is that you're looking for in the streams, but that the two approaches should be used in hand. With the eDNA approach, we used a single species eDNA approach where we specifically targeted coastal cutthroat trout. But of the 60 streams we went out to, there were two fishes that were found higher than coastal cutthroat trout in those stream networks. So in one stream, we found a coho salmon higher than coastal cutthroat trout, and in the other one, we found a sculpin higher than coastal cutthroat trout. And we were only able to determine that because of electrofishing for the reason you brought up, which is that we can capture a broader assemblage of species because we can target all the animals, the organisms that are found there.
It would seem to me that electrofishing could be accused of being inhumane. The work of Victoria Braithwaite 10 years ago seemed to establish that fish feel pain. Trout, she injected trout with bee venom and watched their behaviour, and then she treated them with morphine, and lo and behold, the trout reverted to normal behaviour. They didn't avoid strange objects in the tank and things like that. So it would seem to me that electrofishing could be, in a sense, cruel. If they do feel pain, but eDNA is harmless in that regard. Is this a dimension to what you're doing?
This is definitely an aspect of what it is we're looking at. So a big benefit of eDNA is that you don't have to handle or harm or even harass the fishes. Because one thing you do when you electrofish for the last fish, which is different than how we normally electrofish to work fish up, you only want the fish to roll in the stream because you're just confirming they're there for the distribution boundary edge. But when you typically electrofish, you would be able to have that fish in hand, but that also gives you additional information if you're interested in their size or their weight, and you want to understand other aspects of the size distribution of those, that population or the species, you need to have a fish in hand for that type of information.
And Brooke, you've obviously done a lot of work in terms of presence or absence, but obviously the holy grail will be for your team to be able to give some idea of the biomass, of the actual weight of fish, if that's present. Have you done any science to try and relate the actual amount of DNA with the actual density of fish that are present in the area that you're sampling?
Yes, we have. And we've found, along with other researchers, that there seems to be a relationship between the two, that essentially what we get with eDNA is a good metric for relative abundance, and especially when we compare it to the abundance that we capture with electrofishing. And so they follow the same pattern shape. You get bumps, you know, where you would expect them, and the shape looks the same between the two. But again, it's a measure of relative abundance. But the additional thing that you can get with eDNA, you can also get at genetic variability. And so we have some new work coming out where you're able to actually understand the genetic variability of the populations in the water sample that you're sampling, which allows you to manage differently than even managing for abundance. And so in a lot of ways, that's the holy grail that I think researchers want to be managing for, because we want to manage for stocks of our fishes to have the widest variability possible.
It's very interesting, Brooke, to hear you describing your work. I have a great sense of deja vu, because here in Ireland now for a number of years, we also have been attempting to try and bring eDNA into the management of our fish. And we've done exactly what you're describing with Atlantic salmon. And again, confounded some of our management colleagues by finding very small numbers of Atlantic salmon above barriers that they thought certainly no adult salmon could get over. So it was really, really important. But the other thing we've started to do now, we're taking a great interest in predatory birds. And we're beginning now to look at the eDNA of the scat from the predatory birds and to try and get an idea over the year how their diet varies in terms of particularly the salmonids, and particularly in your case, the cutthroat trout and the Pacific salmon would be the equivalent target species. Have you similar work ongoing in terms of predation and predators, say from mammals or bird species?
Yeah, there is work going on by other researchers in the area, and they're doing just that. They're looking at scat and they're identifying what species they're eating and how much of their diet consists of an aquatic diet. So for example, we're finding that our raccoons eat a lot of crayfishes and owls eat a lot of our salamander and trout. And so we're, you know, able to identify the proportion of their diets that's dedicated to an aquatic diet and then identifying what in the aquatic systems they're eating.
Talking about predators and detecting them, here in Ireland, in UCD, PhD, conducting a study of lamprey using eDNA. I'd like to know what salmon lovers think of lamprey. Is this, I have a slight suspicion that you are hostile to mergansers and cormorants and things like that. Are you also hostile to lampreys?
Well, Richard, I don't think we're hostile to anything, to be honest. I think, and certainly my colleagues in UCD that do all this magic eDNA work, Jens Carlson and his team, they've done a lot of work on lampreys. And the lampreys and all of the other species are obviously really important in terms of the ecology that our salmon and that our trout live in. So really what we're trying to do is to understand the interrelationships between the different species. And the eDNA gives us a wonderful opportunity to do that, because not alone can we look at the vertebrates, but we can look at the invertebrates and the species that are under pressure, like our very precious freshwater mussels. So the eDNA gives us a great toolbox to look at the ecosystem and the biodiversity within that ecosystem. It's not a matter of picking out any particular species, but trying to understand how they relate to one another.
And in the Pacific Northwest of the United States, lamprey are also important symbolically and culturally for our tribes. So in addition to being important ecologically, they also have a role in their community.
Brooke, it's fascinating stuff. Thank you very much indeed for taking the time to speak with us today.
Thank you so much, Derek. I appreciate it. It was fun.
Now, on a bright, crisp morning, there's nothing more pleasant than pulling on the old boots and heading for the hills for a bracing walk through the woods. Some of us are lucky that beautiful areas lie within our 5 kilometre restriction, while others can only dream about getting into the forests again.
I'm going out walking down through the park. Walking down through the park.
Quilcha Nature, the new division of the state-owned forestry company Quilcha, owns about half of the mountainous forests in County Dublin. These forests are among the most important recreational sites for a growing urban population seeking fresh air and green space. And their most popular forest, Tiknock, usually attracts more than 500 visitors a day. Until now, Quilcha has managed the forest primarily for commercial purposes, and their recreational value hasn't been written into development plans. But because of their popularity and proximity to the city, they've decided now to put people's needs much higher up the agenda. And this will be reflected in the Dublin Mountain Makeover Project. COVID restrictions have currently stopped work on this ambitious plan to transform an area of forest that's larger than the Phoenix Park. We're talking about 900 hectares or thereabouts. And the idea is to make it more colourful and more people-friendly. Anne and Ilana spoke with Kieran Fallon, director of Quilcha Nature, about the project.
Hello, Kieran. How are you doing? It's good to talk to you. I'm always very interested in trees, being president of the Tree Council of Ireland. So maybe you could start off by telling us all about Quilcha.
Well, Quilcha is the state-owned forestry company, and it was established in 1989. Prior to that, all forestry in Ireland was done directly by the civil service. And in 1989, a decision was taken to take the forestry from the civil service out and vest it into a new company called Quilcha, and its remit was to provide a financial return on the state's investment in forestry. You'll know from your role in the Tree Council, the history of forestry in Ireland, there was very little forestry in Ireland when the state was formed, and the early decades of the state really focused on afforestation, and that's the land that was vested in Quilcha.
And then we have Quilcha Nature then, which is a very exciting development of Quilcha. Tell us about that.
Quilcha Nature was an idea that came up as we approached our 30-year anniversary. When Quilcha was formed in 1989, ideas of climate change and biodiversity loss were really not in wide circulation. But times have moved on, and in recent years, we've been trying to understand how we can deliver more on climate change and biodiversity, how we can retain a relevance in the future. And Quilcha Nature was an innovation that our board decided to set up. So it's a division that looks after not-for-profit activities around climate change and biodiversity loss. So we're looking at major conservation projects, nature restoration projects, and we hope later this year to get involved in native woodland afforestation projects again.
you have started off then this new approach, this new work with Caoilte Nature on the Dublin Mountains, because the Dublin Mountains are an area just south of a million people, and they're a huge nature resource, they're a huge amenity for the people of Dublin. So it's looking at those you are first. So, I mean, we look at the Dublin Mountains and we see great stands of conifers, great stands of mostly spruce, but lodgepole pine maybe as well in larch. And you are now going to be Caoilte Naturing those. So what are your plans for that?
From where I'm standing now, I'm looking out my window. I live in Dublin and I can see them. This around the whole south of the city. These forests were planted in the late 1950s and early 1960s, when Dublin was a much smaller city, probably had a population of around a little bit over a third of what it has now. So much smaller city. And these were rural forests, and there were places where people didn't really recreate. So they were set up as commercial plantation forests back then. But over the time, the city has really expanded and changed in its nature, and outdoor recreation has become much more popular. So over the years, these forests have, their timber production use has really been overtaken by their recreational and biodiversity use. In fact, part of the green infrastructure of the city. So in recognition of that, our board decided to put nine of these forests, 900 hectares, so a really huge area, into the Caoilte Nature programme. And they're being converted from plantation forests into nature and recreation forests. So it, as you say, they were planted originally with conifer species, production species, in plantation formats to ensure that they're growing long, straight trees, which are useful for timber production. But now we're trying to change that over time to forests which have different age structure and species diversity and so on, and more light to allow them to take on a stronger recreational and biodiversity function.
So if you have a mature conifer stand that's been planted and is ready for harvesting, the trees are tall and thin and no light getting through, because the point of it is that they don't have side branches. Are you going to clear fell and plant again? Are you going to take out a few trees? Will there be problems with wind throw? How actually are you going to do it? And have you done any of it yet?
Yeah, we're going to do it by a combination of two approaches. One is CCF, continuous cover forestry. So where possible, we'll remove a portion of the trees, allowing more light in and allowing the floor of the forest to open up. As you correctly say, as plantations, they are planted very closely together to promote straight growth, but it doesn't create a lot of light on the forest floor. So we'll open up those forests to allow light in, and we will plant in these spaces created with native species to encourage species diversity and encourage a different age structure within the forest, because the plantations are all of the same age. That won't be possible everywhere, because as you say, these are elevated forests, they're high up on the hill, and they weren't planted originally for CCF. They were planted to be clear felled. So very often they don't have great wind resistance. So in some cases, we will have to take down the mature Sitka spruce or lodgepole pine forest and directly replace. And we call it R&R, remove and replace. So we'll replace it with native species. We started our first interventions in June of last year, of 2020, and we did both CCF, continuous cover that I described earlier, and the clear felling to replace. And I'm delighted to say we did our first planting of native species on a site up on Tiknock, which is one of our most popular forests, just beside the main car park. If any of your listeners walk in Tiknock, they'll see it there. So it's been clear felled, and it was planted up with a mix of Scots pine, rowan, birch in the second week of December.
Have you laid out paths through it? Because I know when people see clear felling, they think it looks really awful with the brash and the rows where the old trees were and everything else. It looks even more uninviting than the forests when they were whole looked. So presumably you've managed it in such a way that there will be walks through it and areas as the trees grow that people can walk amongst them.
Yeah, we have plans to put in paths, but what we do initially is plant up with a relatively high density of plants, and we expect some of the plants not to succeed. We expect some mortality, but the stronger ones will survive. And then once the forest is gaining structure, 7, 8, 9 years, we go in with our recreation team and plan out walks in those forests. Now, any of your listeners who have been up there will see that these clear felled areas that were planted are surrounded with high fencing. Now, there are access gates to allow walkers to walk through, but the gates are there to actually keep deer out. There's a very high population of deer in the Dublin uplands, and they love young plants, particularly young broadleafs. So they'll browse on the young plants if we don't protect them. So that's what the fencing is there for. But people can pass through that fencing at the gates.
And have you put up information panels informing people, or have you just done it and put up the fencing and said nothing? I mean, can people who park their cars and go walking see that there is a plan, that it isn't just more harvesting or whatever that they get the wrong idea of? Have you put up notice boards about it?
We've really tried to communicate as much as we possibly could on the project, because when we announced this, there was such an overwhelmingly positive response. People were really up for it. People were very excited about it, and people wanted to learn more. So we've put together a website and also a newsletter, which your listeners can subscribe to. It's Quilch and Nature News, and they'll be on a list and get bulletins. And on the sites, we've put up panels where we try to explain the whole plan and what's happening locally. Because people really love these forests. They feel them, they're part of the city, they're part of their recreation. They want to enjoy them. And we've, I think, a duty to explain what we're doing and what the bigger plan is. So we're doing our really best, putting a lot of effort into communicating on this project. And hopefully people are getting a good understanding of what's going on.
Now, all of the forests up there aren't mature and full of old age. You have younger stands, younger conifer stands, where the trees are much smaller. Are you managing them in a different way? Are you taking out some of those trees before there's a problem with windrow and things? Or what are you doing with younger conifer stands that haven't reached maximum height?
With the young ones, you have an opportunity to intervene early and really promote continuous cover forestry. So the ones that might have been planted before this plan was developed, maybe in the last 15 years, they're at a stage where you're talking about young trees coming up, their root system hasn't fully developed, and we can go in and extract some of those trees and then promote that stability, that wind stability that I spoke about earlier on, and allow them to develop more of a continuous cover approach and manage them on a continuous cover basis. So the young ones we'll try to catch early. The older forests will be ones where we go for the CCF opening or the remove and replace approach.
So there'll be continuous cover. So these will always then be wooded areas. Hopefully, as time goes on, with more and more deciduous species, species with berries, fruit, nuts, all of these things that are going to improve the biodiversity of the area. Will there be management for nasty things like rhododendron and stuff like that? Or will you just take whatever grows as part of the biodiversity?
No, I mean, a major part of the work is always the removal of invasive species, both rhododendron and other invasives. As you know, that is a major problem. It's a very tricky thing to manage. It involves a lot of labour, high cost labour to remove infestations. But that is part of the whole programme, and we'll be continuously doing that throughout the project.
So maybe we'll have National Tree Week in 2022 celebrated up there. I think 2021, National Tree Week is in March. We'll hardly be doing it in 2021, but we can look forward to it in 2022, can we not, Ciarán?
We certainly can. Wouldn't that be something? Let's think about that. Unfortunately, at the moment, not only have we difficulties doing operational work, but we're discouraging people in accordance with the lockdown rules from travelling outside their 5K. So they're quieter than usual at the moment. But hopefully when we have this all behind us, we can celebrate and have some great outdoor events and perhaps even National Tree Week.
Why not, indeed? That's pretty much all we have time for today. Don't forget to visit the website anytime you like, rte.ie/Mooney. My thanks, as always, to Dr. Richard Collins, to Éanann Éilíonna, Niall Hatch and Dr. Ken Whelan, our researcher, John Bell O'Reilly, and our broadcast coordinator, Jarlath Holland. Not forgetting today's producer, Anna Leddy. Until next week, goodbye.
Look deep into nature, said Albert Einstein, and you will understand everything better. And where better to celebrate our natural world than in the art of nature photography? Calling all budding photographers and nature lovers alike. Join us for the first Eye on Nature Wildlife Photography Competition. To enter, see rte.ie/eyeonnature. For updates, watch The Today Show on RTE One and tune in to Mooney Goes Wild on RTE Radio One. Eye on Nature, presented by RTE with the National Botanic Gardens Dublin and the Office of Public Works. RTE Eye on Nature. See the world.
And Mooney Goes Wild was presented and produced by Derek Mooney.